I want to just say how honored I am, really, and pleased and moved to be here with Lynn Stewart. I just think it's... you hear this very, very depressing stuff, you know, basically living in a lawless country right now, overseas and abroad, one in which really the veneer of civilization that we had on is just being stripped away, back to a barbarism, and you get very, very depressed and sad about it. And then I read last week, Lynn Stewart is indicted, and I just couldn't believe it. And then the next day I hear Lynn on Democracy Now, and I said, where would I have been? I would have been in some hole trying to get out of here. And she is on the front line fighting and fighting and fighting and making this the struggle. And not, I'm sure, worried about herself, but talking about it as if it's the struggle that's really going on in this country now about John Ashcroft and civil liberties and the struggle for all of us. And I just think that kind of courage and that kind of militancy, despite what we've heard, is something we have to all be very proud of and take a really good example from. Thank you, Lynn. As I said, it was a bad week. Lynn being indicted, and then, of course, the continuing atrocities of the Israelis in the occupied territories. Then yesterday, you read in the New York Times, of course, about the coup in Venezuela and what happened to Chavez. And then you read what the Times says, which is basically, you know, the old adage, this one, though, one man's coup is another's return to democracy, which is what the Times' position on it was. And then, of course, following it last night and having Chavez regain the presidency in Venezuela, which is an incredible thing. As Yogi Berra said, it ain't over till it's over. And really, it was something that gave me a real shot in the arm last night and this morning to see that there's that kind of fight back going on in the rest of the world. I want to go back to Lynn for one second, because Lenny talked about the Foreign Sovereign Intelligence Surveillance Act and what had happened to the warrant requirements of the Fourth Amendment. And Lynn is, I don't like to use the word poster child because she's an adult, but That was the wiretapping act that they used to wiretap her when she was in prison for 2 or 3 years, whatever, when she was visiting in prison and all her phone conversations. And now, of course, they're using that act to try and justify Ashcroft's next step, which is to wiretap even without going to the secret court of the Foreign Intelligence Court. So they're saying, Ashcroft is saying, see, an attorney was doing this, and therefore I don't even want to go to the secret court. I want to just be able to wiretap attorneys and clients on their own. And that's basically, if you have to look at one reason why I think they indicted Lynn along these lines, was to try and justify Ashcroft's new regulation, basically, which says that he can wiretap attorneys and their clients whenever he chooses. Now, why shouldn't he have to go to a court? It's completely unclear to me, much less the Foreign Surveillance Intelligence Court, but a regular Fourth Amendment court. Why should he be able to do that? But so now you have first the Fourth Amendment, then the court Lenny described, and now you have Ashcroft's signature saying, I can wiretap when I want. So that's really Lynn's case and how it's being used for that. Abdin is on the board of the Center, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, and a few weeks ago we were discussing all of the aggressive actions we were starting to take with regard to post 9/11 civil liberties violations both here and abroad. And we were sitting around the room and we've talked about a number of cases we're filing with our organization, with the ACLU, with the National Lawyers Guild, both on getting the names of the detainees here, on getting the secret detention trials, the secret detention hearings open. We've actually had some victories in both those cases on the Guantanamo detainees, the people that I represent in Guantanamo, and others. And Abdin says, look, it's good that there's this fight back. It's really important. It's crucial. But in the end, the courts aren't going to give you what you need here. You're obviously going to have to organize among people as well. But as long as what's going on outside of the United States is going on, as long as the United States is continuing to do what it's doing overseas, whether in Palestine and Israel or in the rest of the Middle East or in the rest of the world, there are going to be conditions in the world in which the United States is going to be a target and in which U.S. people are going to be a target. And how are you going to convince people in the United States and the courts to somehow lift the draconian measures that are against people right now, as long as they're feeling and living in terror and in fear of terror? And I think he's right. So I think that there's a clear link between talking about civil liberties here and how we can protect them here and what the United States is doing overseas. And there's an old expression that that I use occasionally. It's he who plunders others always lives in terror. And I think that's the case. And as long as we are plundering others, we will live in terror, and we will continue to have governments that respond to that in a very, very draconian way. Today, in the few minutes I have, I want to talk about a few of the themes and then talk about Guantanamo, some of the Guantanamo issues and international law issues. Some of the themes that I think characterize this period are, one is having a war abroad, obviously, which is always means cutbacks in civil liberties. But in this case, we also have a war at home, in the sense that there was an attack within the United States, and the United States has conceptualizing this as a war against terrorism at home and a war abroad. And so you take that, you couple that with the kind of thugs that we have in office right now, whether it's Ashcroft in the Justice Department or Cheney and Wolfowitz, and the others in the executive, and you're talking about a very, very very, very serious situation in which you can get through almost anything right now in the United States. That's one of the themes that I think is going on right now. A second one, and Abdin referred to it, is the attacks against non-citizens. The original attacks have all come down until really the indictment of Lynn, have all been almost entirely against non-citizens, whether it's the detentions here, whether it's the detentions in Guantanamo, whether it's the way the Patriot Act is phrased. And that's done for a number of reasons. It's done, one, is it's easier to get U.S. people to go along with them because they'll say, it's the other. It's not me. It's not me as a citizen. It's the other. And therefore, they'll get these laws through. So a second theme that's been going on is this theme against non-citizens. A third one is, it's been referred to a number of times, about the U.S. moving toward a police state. Some people would say arriving there. But what I see as a police state means that they're really not what we would have called the checks and balances on government that somehow rein in unfettered executive discretion to do things. And in that sense, I think we are really moving strongly in that direction. If you look at what I call the issue of arbitrary detentions, basically civilization and law has spent their really hundreds of years fighting against the idea that an executive can simply say, Michael Ratner, you go to jail, Abdin, you go to jail, and have no court review, no court process, and no evidence and no charges against you. That's not the case any longer in the United States. The detainees now in prison are in there without any charges and are being held basically in arbitrary and indefinite detention. The detainees in Guantanamo are being held arbitrarily and under indefinite detention, no court review, basically nothing you can do about it. There's a number of hallmarks about this increasing executive power, but it is one that, if you have to say leading toward a police state, I would characterize this country as going in that direction right now very, very, very strongly. A fourth theme, I would say, is that there is no effort whatsoever to look at root causes of terrorism. None. In fact, you're considered to be supporting terrorism when you even open your mouth to say, well, maybe there's some people angry at us for this reason or that reason. No effort at all, and it goes back to the conversation we had earlier when I talked about what Abdin said with regard to how you're going to have to get at what are the causes before you can get at how to stop it. All these draconian laws, is the fifth theme, will not stop it. Building a fortress America cannot be done in a way that will stop terrorism. We have 10,000 miles of border with Mexico, or 7,500 miles of border with Mexico and Canada. You have, I think the number is 11 million trucks come into the United States all the time. Millions of people in and out. How are they ever going to stop someone who wants to harm America? They're not going to be able to. These laws are not about that. They can't do it. It won't happen with that. It will only happen if there's a real, real change in fundamental values of how this country operates, both here and overseas. Because people always ask me when I get through a talk of all the dangers, well, what do you suggest? How are we going to stop terrorism? The answer is I certainly don't have the answer to that, but I certainly know it's not by taking away the Fourth Amendment, then taking away the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and allowing Lynn Stewart to be wiretapped based on John Ashcroft's signature. That's not the way we're going to stop terrorism. The particular case that I'm working on right now, the center is working on a number of these cases. We're actually about to file a big case on behalf of the detainees here in prison in the United States. I have been working for a number of weeks on the Guantanamo detainees, and that situation, if you look at what's going on in the world with regard to what the U.S. role is, it's reflected in how it's treating the Guantanamo detainees, which is to say it's overthrowing the entire structure of law that certainly for 100 years under the Geneva Conventions and probably 1,000 years going back to post-Roman times as to how people were to be treated when they were captured in battle by one side or the other. And the U.S., as it has done even before 9/11, has always used international law very selectively. When it helps us, we'll use it or we'll use the U.N. When it doesn't, we'll reject it. Post 9/11, of course, that theme has been exacerbated. The U.S. now just really does whatever it wants. I mean, let's be very clear in the world, whatever it wants. Law is absolutely no bar. And if I look at the people in Guantanamo, there's 300 people there now. They're kept still in these cages. I was in Guantanamo in 1991 when I represented Haitian refugees. It's an utter hellhole. It's a place of scorpions and banana rats and heat that's unbearable. The idea that one would be put into essentially a dog run in there is quite remarkable to me. The idea that people are kept in these open-air cages where the elements are there is also quite amazing. It's gotten basically, no real press anymore here at all. But the other thing is, the other issue is how they're being held. The Geneva Conventions are very clear. The Third Geneva Convention says when you're picked up on the battlefield, you have to initially be treated as a prisoner of war. If you're not going to be treated as a prisoner of war, you have to be given a special court or tribunal that will decide whether you should be a prisoner of war or not. Now, obviously, that's a crucial issue. If you're not a prisoner of war, if you're not really someone who had a right to shoot arms in an army, then you're basically committing murder whenever you pick up a gun in an army. So it's obviously crucial. And it's very clear, the conventions are clear. The U.S. in every single war has actually followed that convention, has set up the special tribunals in Vietnam, in Grenada, in Panama, in Iraq, in every single one of these wars has actually had the special tribunals. So this is an incredible departure for the United States to simply say, we're going to ignore this, not treat anybody as a prisoner of war, and arbitrarily detain them. And that's what they're doing. They're arbitrarily detaining them. And who are these people? Well, they haven't given us any access, so it's hard to know who they are. The particular clients I'm representing, they appear to me to be 25, 30-year-old foot soldiers, essentially, who were fighting against the Northern Alliance for the Taliban. The U.S. then comes in. They get captured by the Northern Alliance. They get turned over to the U.S. Because they're foreigners, the U.S. takes them, puts them on Guantanamo, with absolutely no access to attorneys or anything else. Huge outcry in the international community. International Red Cross basically said they needed to have hearings. They can't be treated like this. Europe said the same thing. The U.S. then stages a press conference in which it says, well, we're going to apply the Geneva Conventions. And everybody goes, oh, great, we're going to apply the Geneva Conventions. But in fact, it didn't apply the Geneva Conventions at all. It just said it. And then everybody goes away. It never gave anybody a hearing. There, everybody's still sitting in the cages with no access to anybody and not being treated as prisoners of war. In some way, you could argue, let's talk about for a second where they are. They're in Guantanamo. Now, we all know the history of Guantanamo. It's a part of Cuba, taken essentially by force by the United States under a bilateral lease that requires both parties to break it, so it can't be broken just by Cuba. It's in, as I said, a very remote part of Cuba. And the key for the United States is not only is it violating international law here, but there's no way to get into an American court, according to the United States. When we went in on the Guantanamo Haitians in 1991, I remember the court argument down here in the Second Circuit, they turned to the government and they said, you mean to say you can do whatever you want to the people in Guantanamo? You can torture them, you can throw them overboard. And the government said, basically, we can do whatever we want in the sense that this court cannot tell us anything about what we can do. We're only restrained by international law, but of course there's nowhere to enforce it. That's the same position they've now taken with regard to the habeas corpus petition we filed on the Guantanamo detainees. The government has taken the position no court in the United States can hear them. No court in Cuba, of course, according to the United States, can hear them. It's basically a piece of land out in outer space that a government can do. A military can do whatever they want altogether to those people. Now, in some way, I look at the Guantanamo people, and I look at the Guantanamo people as the lucky ones. Why do I say lucky? They're sitting in cages down in Guantanamo. But look what else the United States is doing. People that don't go to Guantanamo, where do they go? They picked up people in Bosnia. They've picked up people in Pakistan. They send them to countries that our CIA is friendly with. The CIAs of their countries, whatever they're called, to Jordan, to Egypt, where those people get turned over to the intelligence agencies there and most likely are being tortured right while we're sitting here. So that's what's happening to the people that aren't going to Guantanamo. And speaking of torture, it should be said that the detainees here, some of whom we don't know anything about, may very well have been subjected to that kind of thing. There were a couple of articles surfaced in the United States that they were, in the U.S. press, that they were getting frustrated by the fact they couldn't get some of the people to talk and that they might have to use what they called Israeli pressure tactics. And if they couldn't use those because it's illegal, maybe we'll send them to another country to be tortured. So that's the kind of law we're talking about. That's the kind of government we're talking about right now. That's the kind of abolition, really, of the very protections that we have taken, I'm afraid, too for granted in the United States that are no longer with us. I do want to say that when I took the Guantanamo cases, you know, there was a lot of discussion about it. Should you really represent these kinds of people? You know, who knows what kinds of people they really are. But should you really represent them? And when you do anything on any publicity on it, you get nothing but hate mail. I mean, hundreds of pieces of hate mail if you even ask for conditions to be better for the people in Guantanamo. But I will say I agree with Clark that at this point, in this particular political moment in the United States, you have to start by defending the first victims of what's going on in this country right now. And those people are... those people in Guantanamo, the people here in the detention facilities all around this city and in the adjacent states, those people are the first victims. And they must be defended. There's a lot of fight left in us, as you can see by having our wonderful friend Lynn here. So let's go on and hear from Lynn, and thank you very much.